Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Henrietta, Oklahoma, and one of the last surviving members of the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment from World War II, an outfit recognized with the Presidential Unit Citation for its heroics during the Battle of the Bulge. When we left off, Mr. Harvey had shared how toward the end of the war in Europe, when most of the 101st Airborne was sent to the Ruhr Pocket to help root out remaining German forces, the 501st was held back to prepare for a combat jump with the intent of liberating Allied prisoners from German POW camps.
I guess that makes me think, too.
If word had come that the enemy was going to start executing some of those prisoners.
I guess that makes me think, too. Because there are all these POW camps throughout German-occupied territory, and some people sometimes get those confused with the other camps, the concentration camps. Were you at all aware during this time of those concentration camps or what Hitler was doing?
No. Oh, when after the surrender, here was all what we call the DPs, the dispossessed people, wandering all over Europe. You couldn't help but know that they had been in the, not necessarily called concentration camps, but they were in camps, and there was displaced people from all these different countries had been transported back to Germany.
And you saw some of them?
Oh, everybody saw them because they were everywhere. Yeah, and they talk about the insecticide, DDT, and here they had that, and they pulled up the shirt, and ends up, and they squirt them all with DDT.
You mentioned the surrender. Do you have a memory of VE Day and what that meant for you and the guys with you?
No, because there again, we were on the alert to jump. So we were on a combat status all that end of the there to, on. And of course, there was the false VE Day. But no, to us, it was still combat.
Well, tell me about the false VE Day.
Well, there where one day they said it was victory and the war was over, and it was a false report, and it was still going on, and it was a week or two later that the actual fighting stopped.
No. So when it finally was over, when Germany did surrender on May the 8th of 1945, did that change anything for you after that?
No. We was in France, and the division was in Bavaria, you know, at Bircher Squadron.
Yeah.
So we then went down and joined the division and became part of the occupation. So we were spread out.
Did you get to go see the Eagle's Nest there that they were hanging out at?
Bircher Squadron, yes, but wasn't up into the Eagle's Nest, but there was the barracks, you know, down below and where they were.
And I'm just thinking about some of the things that you've shared. You know, you talked about the young man who was killed on that very first day, and then the other one, Gulick, who you carried all this way to try to save him, and you find out he was dead. Then you get to the end of this war, and Germany's surrendered. The fact that you guys prevailed against that enemy, knowing some of those who had given their lives, was that meaningful to you?
No. Somewhere along there, we were slated for the invasion of Japan. So for us, the war wasn't over. We were going to, it was just an interval till we were going to be fighting in Japan.
So you're there in Germany, but they're telling you, get ready, and you haven't made a combat jump yet, and you're thinking, I'm going to have to jump behind enemy lines in Japan?
Not then, but that was just being a paratrooper. That was going to be part of it.
I know hypotheticals are really hard, you know. It's who knows what would have happened. But have you ever thought about it? What would have happened if you had to jump into Japan?
No, because that ended, you know, before we left while we were still overseas, still in Europe. And by then, we knew.
When I had the privilege of shaking your hand here, you handed me something. It's a picture of a young paratrooper, and you told me what the occasion was that that picture was taken, and there aren't too many people around who were part of this, but when you came back to the States, you were part of something significant.
Well, I didn't know then we were going to be in this. They initiated the point system for discharge, and the 501st was never an integral part of the 101st Airborne Division. It was attached. It was not assigned, although all the combat experience and everything was with the 101st. So they started discharging troops. And there again, I was sent to a glider battalion, the 81st AAAT battalion. Now, that was one disappointment because I thought, well, I'll get to make a glider flight. And that didn't happen. But there was one aspect of my career that changed. Paratroopers were egotistical. And as I said, we thought we were different then on. And the glidermen, if they were men, they would volunteer for the paratroopers instead of riding a glider. The glidermen did not volunteer. The Army took the attitude, we can put you in a truck, we can put you in a glider. But the battalion I was in, the battery was equipped with 50 caliber for anti-aircraft event. But they didn't have any use for them as anti-aircraft, so they sent them up on the lines with the infantry and with the paratroopers. So there was where I learned, well, here, the battery I'm in had been up on the line with the paratroopers, and they're fighting. Only we're getting $50 extra a month. They're getting nothing. So then they changed that and then started paying the gliders $50. But that was one aspect. But there again, we thought we were different. And I think we were.
And on the flip side of that, because I've talked to some of those guys too, I mean, there were some parallels. They could only go one way, too. There was no going back. I mean, that glider was going to land behind enemy lines, and they were going to have to fight their way out of there just like you guys would.
Yeah. Then they deactivated the 17th Airborne Division overseas. They split them up and sent part of them to the 82nd and the 101st. Have you ever heard of the 1st Special Service Forces?
Yeah, the Red Devils?
Yeah, which was British and the American unit on, which they deactivated them because of the differences between the cultures. So we got some of the 1st Special Service. They spread them out between the divisions. Then, while we were still overseas, they had deactivated the 17th, assigned them to the 82nd and the 101st. Then they deactivated the 101st overseas, and they transferred all of us into the 82nd. So the 82nd Division, which marched into Victory Parade, was actually three units of 101st, the 17th, the 82nd, and a few 1st Special Service, probably.
So you mean to tell me that, you're a Screaming Eagle who's also an All-American?
Yes, but have no allegiance or anything to the 82nd.
Some folks are aware there is a little bit of a rivalry there. So tell me about this, because you mentioned the Victory Parade. You marched in this Victory Parade in New York City. But coming home, coming back to America, here you've been overseas risking your life. You've seen your fellow soldiers, your fellow paratroopers killed, wounded. You're coming back in one piece physically. I don't know how you felt mentally or emotionally, but what was that like coming back home to the U.S.?
We came back on the Queen Mary. There again, it was a troop ship, and we was all there. The only thing was we didn't worry anything about submarines. You were still in the Army. You were still under that discipline. You were still under that routine. So you didn't know when you was getting out. You were still in the Army.
And this Victory Parade. What do you remember about that? What was it like to be one of those guys who got to march in what was a real symbolic event for the country?
Well, there again, We got up, we had breakfast, and I don't remember which I, you know, how I got from Camp Shakes down to the Battery, you know, lower part of Manhattan. We formed up, it was in companies, and took a position and marched up Fifth Avenue and to the end and went over and got back on the trains and went back to Camp Shanks. So really to us, it was nothing. We knew we was marching up the Victory Parade, but there you still use in your unit, your platoon. There was this fellow over here who had been there at breakfast time and previous there and was there after. So,
but that wasn't an empty Fifth Avenue. There were a lot of people lining both sides of it to, yeah, to cheer you on as you marched. Yeah. Did that make an impression on you?
No, there again, depend all where you were in the ranks, because you could be here in the middle of the company, and you couldn't see really down here, people over here, but there again, you were marching as a unit. It wasn't that big of a deal at that time. The band was way up front, and yeah, as I said, to us, it was a hike.
And then you end up getting discharged from the Army. And I'm just wondering if you can put it in perspective for me, the difference between that 18-year-old who got drafted out of Henrietta, Oklahoma, and the 21-year-old wearing a combat infantry badge when he came back home.
Well, when I got back home, there wasn't that many people there in my hometown that I had, you know, went to school with or kids, because a lot of those had got back, gone to school, enrolled in college. I'd gotten back a little late. My brother was going to school at Kansas University, so I went up to visit him, and they was just starting to enroll there, so I enrolled in college. There again, in the 30s, and when I was in high school, there wasn't that many children or kids in high school that would be going on to college. Let's say it was the well-to-do people, the children of the well-to-do people. That was something unusual at that time. When I went, started to KU, there was maybe only a couple of thousand students there. Now, that's the big difference. And all of that's a result of the GI Bill.
And that was my next question. You beat me to the punch. It sounds like the GI Bill made a pretty big difference in your life.
Oh, that affected everybody's life. That was the big thing. It was the GI Bill in all the soldiers' lives.
And is that where you met your wife, at KU?
Yes.
Good thing you made it home, I guess, huh?
Yes. Now, there's one aspect of this thing that I've often thought about. When I was in the Bulge, I was separated from when I went out to that roadblock. Then I'd hooked up with a glider company for a couple of weeks, but word got back to my unit that I'd been wounded. So my mother received a telegram saying I'd been wounded in action and further information would come from the hospital. It was almost a month till she got another telegram saying it was a mistake that I had not been wounded. But I've often thought, well, there was my mother that said, here your baby boy has been wounded and is in a hospital, but had no idea how serious or how anything else. So what was her thoughts during that month? Now, I've often wondered about that. But I never knew she had received those telegrams until 60, 70 years later.
So she wasn't around to answer that question anymore. And what'd you get your degree in?
I didn't get a degree. I had extra hours. But my last semester and on there when I was a senior, why, they come up and they said, you need 2 hours of biology. And that was a freshman course. They enrolled me in insects and man biology, entomology course, which was a biology. There it wasn't entomology, it was biology. Well, when I got to the class, it was medical entomology. Well, that time I was married and had a baby in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I got an F in that course because I was hitchhiking to Tulsa and back. And then Sunday, I'd hitchhike back. I had also enrolled in the advanced ROTC because I got a little money. So I was head of the ROTC unit there because I'd been to cadre school and I had all experience and everything. So when the semester was over, sergeant charge of the ROTC called me down. He was stayed in as an old hand. He said, "Do you want this commission or not?" And I said, "Oh, I guess so." Well, he says, "I'll make a appointment for you to take a physical up at Fort Leavenworth tomorrow morning." I hitchhiked to Fort Leavenworth, took my physical, and he says, "Sign these papers. I'll fill them out later on." So I signed all the papers, and he took over. So I hitchhiked to Fort Leavenworth, took the physical, and hitchhiked to Tulsa and got a job, and Korea broke out. A couple of weeks later, I ran into a kid there on the streets of Tulsa who would in ROTC with me, and he says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "We've all been called up." I said, "I haven't heard anything from them." Well, because I'd flunked that course, why then I needed that two-hour course in order to get a degree, which would have been in geology. So I didn't get a degree. I didn't get commissioned because I wasn't a graduate. So that changed my life because I thought as a infantry second lieutenant, I would have been in Korea, boom. What would I have done then? That would have affected my life. Yeah. But that didn't happen. So
not that we're advising this to any students today, but it sounds like you're saying that getting an F may have saved your life.
Yes. Well, second lieutenants didn't last very long in the infantry. And with combat experience, yeah. Now, I would have volunteered for the paratroops for sure, and I'd have asked to have been assigned to the 82nd because that was the other, along with the 11th, which was in Asia. But no.
What a fragile balance. So many twists of fate evident throughout Mr. Harvey's story, but we're not done yet. Every veteran's story is unique, and we're going to hear more of how he really feels when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.